Wafting across the pastoral vistas of the new basement studios by the lake, this is the Atlantic Voice Podcast, 3,000 miles of opinion.
This is the Atlantic Voice Podcast. I'm Zeph.
And I'm Eric.
Down in the new basement studios by the lake, we have just played the track fanfare.
Is that what it's called? That was about...
I don't know. I assume it's called the fanfare. And so let me explain what that just was. When you go to a horse race here, or in this instance, a greyhound race, to sort of bring the crowd to attention that the race is shortly beginning, they always play that fanfare over the tannoy. And then you'll hear in the announcer doing the sixth race today at Fort Myers Dog Track, beginning shortly. And then that's sort of the sign for this is your last chance to place your bets on this race because the race is shortly happening. So
You said over here.
Well, I don't know. I don't remember. I used to go greyhound racing in England when I was a kid. I do not think they did that. And I've never been to horse racing in England, so I cannot compare. I've only ever watched it on TV. You have something there. So while you get...
No, I didn't want to plug in. I just was realizing. What'll be next? Our order is going to be your stuff first. Sorry.
Okay, sorry.
Everybody's seeing the sausage be made.
Yeah, we are making sausage. This is a long way around of explaining that I've just got back from Florida. And when I was in Florida, because I'm not the sort of person who lies around on the beach, I spent two afternoons going...
Also, you were in an overcrowded resort room, right? We don't have to get to specifics, there was reasons to get away.
I felt like I was a refugee family making across the border. I spent two afternoons away at the dog track, because that is something you can do in Florida. You can go to a dog track, watch the dogs race, bet on the dogs, also go inside and they had a poker room, and you can also bet on all the other stuff
poker
going on.
Room. Did you play poker?
I don't play poker. I'm old fashioned.
That's a big step. I don't recall you being a poker player.
I only bet on animals and or sports. But I don't play poker and stuff like that myself.
Friends of mine, we're actually toying with the idea of going to the MGM casino here today, but I'm not sure we're going to do it. It's a Saturday. It could be too crowded.
Probably would be crowded, yeah. Plus, they had a murder there a couple of weeks ago.
What?
Yeah, you didn't know that?
No.
Some guy in one of the restaurants got stabbed or something.
While they're in the restaurant?
I don't know. Or maybe the chef got down. Sorry, we're getting lost here. You know, sorry, I didn't mean to put you off.
It's a factor. I send my text to people.
So anyway, I just got back from Florida and I went to the greyhound races.
Right. What kind of days of the week was it that you were there?
I went on a Thursday afternoon. They have 16 races in the afternoon beginning at 12 o'clock, and then they have nighttime races that began at 7:30. I went to the afternoon session. It's a small little stadium.
Yeah, this is on the Gulf Coast of Florida, right? About midway, Fort Myers area, I think.
Fort Myers, which is basically southern Florida, like it's south of Tampa. It's just north of the Everglades.
Halfway south.
Yeah, Fort Myers, Naples, they have a dog track that's been there for years. A dog track is about, I think it's 600 meters all the way around. So, or 550 meters.
Bigger than a person's running track, obviously much smaller than a horse track.
Yeah, but to be fair, not that much bigger. When you're sitting up in the stadium, right. It's much bigger
when
than...
When people run around a track and they don't have fanfare for that,
it's 400
meters,
So it's not, that's what I'm saying, it's not a lot bigger. Like, yeah. I don't think, I'm not sitting here going, ooh, this is substantially bigger than a running track.
How many would you guess were seating space for?
I don't know. There's basically a big grandstand on one side where you can sit outside in the upper deck and then go underneath to bet. And then below
seats are aluminum bleacher type.
No seats. And then being Florida, it's these nice sort of very comfortable plastic. So
people who don't know, this is high degree of retiree area in this stuff. And so this is all leading to the reason I was asking today is I was going to ask you, who was there? Like, you know, if you had to generalize, the typical person is there.
I think under, you know, if you're going to a Thursday afternoon, right. 12:15 meet, I think down in southern Florida, it's a combination of retirees and the out of work. Now, to be fair, as this was the week, sort of either side of the week leading up to Easter, I would imagine that there were a lot of people, on vacation like myself who were like, ooh, let's go to the dog track for an activity.
It's not something you see everywhere anywhere.
Well, and when I went back on the Saturday.
Kids? Any kids?
Yeah, a couple of kids. And those are the ones I figured were the people on holiday. Yeah. When I went back on the Saturday, it was an overcast day. And obviously, I couldn't decide if it was because it was a Saturday and it was also overcast. The crowd was substantially bigger. I would say 500, 600 people sort of milling around. I don't know. I don't know how accurate. you know, you weren't in some teeming, you know, it didn't look like the Kentucky Derby, let's put it that way, yeah, with throngs of people. But, you
it's
know,
very small infield, so you can't really have much of a thing going on.
Well, there's no one's allowed in the infield at all, yes. But I went there, and like I say, I grew up in London, and in London, when I was a kid, dog racing was big business. Obviously, we have a big betting culture. We have the equivalent of off-track betting in America. Mm-hmm. We have betting shops in England where you can wander in, place bets on football or the tennis or, you know, most of the time it's the daily horse racing and greyhound racing. I do know in the last 15 years, greyhound racing back in the UK has become smaller. A lot of the big old famous tracks closed, including one that I grew up next to. It was one called Walthamstow Stadium, which was famous because it had this really big, massive tote board with neon lights, and it was a famous piece of architecture from like the 30s. And greyhound racing in England has become less popular. I also think part of this is down to the fact that I think in England, the internet has changed how people gamble, meaning that when you can gamble from the ease of your computer, then your relationship with gambling...
Plus you can gamble on real things and not this random...
Why is it real things? Oh. Why is gambling... I mean, horse racing's been around. Horse racing is the sport of kings.
Yeah, but... All right. So horse racing, at least... I mean, horse racing, you could argue, is not even a real thing either because it's too easy to cook and people adjust and stuff like that.
Why is it too easy to cook? I'm going to defend these things very strongly now.
Because people have... There are outsized incentives for people to scam the system.
Okay.
So,
now I want a couple hundred bucks in Florida, so I'm not going to take this position.
An American football game.
Okay.
There's so much money at stake in the game itself and the sport. Doesn't matter how the gambling goes. Like, there's no very few players.
No, that's true. I'll give you that.
Would be convinced to change anything. You always run into a big trouble. This is why college basketball, everybody worries about it, because here's people who aren't paid. You know, it's all the market. If the market for like influencing an outcome, and so the smaller the gambling, the smaller the presence of the sport that the gambling's on, the more likely it's like that. So I don't even know. I was down there myself recently, and we were talking about Hi-Li. Somebody was talking about.
See, Hi-Li. I've always believed that's fixed.
That was the thing. It was fixed
because it's dudes.
Like, when you watch it, you can't even tell. Like if somebody was faking it in basketball, you could kind of tell. Most people would be, I don't mean that you would mostly tell, but some people would be able to observe things going on. But Hi-Li, there's like three people who have any idea what's going on. So,
all right, so I'm going to now concede to you that there is an element, and there could be an element
of the dog tracks, particularly because there aren't even people on the dogs.
But that's what I'm saying. I'm now going to make the case that horse racing, yes, there's a jockey.
Yeah.
So he could manipulate how hard the horse runs in order to upset the money.
Yeah.
To me, the greyhound is the purest form.
Well,
because the greyhound, I mean, that dog's so stupid anyway because he's just running around chasing an electric rabbit. How's he going to be in any which way savvy enough to attempt to fix the race? So you've made the case for me.
No.
The greyhound racing is the purest form of gambling.
A quick, you know, a bad meal or a quick injection of something takes care of a dog.
Well, I'm going to come to that before we segue into our next topic. I'm going to give everyone some gambling
tips. I think we have to talk about the ethics of dog tracks. There's a reason that it's less popular, and part of it is the internet. I interrupted you on that strain of thought, but the other reason is a bunch of people are creeped out by the thing.
I'm going to play something while we talk here.
Yeah, because you're just going to creep people out more.
I have to turn the volume.
Nope, you had the right one the first time.
Do I have the right one? What's going on here?
You do, but it wasn't up. What are you doing? I hear a buzz.
I can't hear anything. What's going on? Oops, there may be, again, people whose sausage is being made as we speak.
Just tell me when you think it's actually
playing. Oh, here we go. Yeah, it's plugged in now. I didn't have it plugged in. You are listening. This is the sound of 8 dogs in the traps getting ready to roll.
The traps being the gates.
The gates. Now, it sounds like they're in agony, but they're not.
Says you.
Well, yeah.
But I...
So this is what it sounds like. So the dogs have been loaded up into the traps, and in a moment, you don't hear very well because I've recorded this on my iPhone or my cell phone.
Well, barely an iPhone. Yeah.
The dogs are in
the
traps.
Who are you talking to there?
I was talking to myself, I think. Yeah. The dog traps open when the little electric rabbit comes zooming by, and then you can hear the bell in the background.
I'm sure nobody could actually hear that.
No. That's also the wind in southern Florida, because while it was 85 degrees, it was a little bit breezy. So the dogs, it still sounds like they're in agony, but in a minute, they're going to roll. And I think that, nope, they're still in the traps right now.
Oh, the bell was just the thing starting, not the gate opening.
Yeah. That's the electric hare going by. And then...
rabbit. Oh,
yep. And there they go. The sounds of the dog track.
Yes, I mean, so romantic.
I got to tell you something. I had a fine old time. Like I say, I used to go and watch greyhound racing in my youth. And there is a part of me that when we retire and we're doing this show from perhaps the sunny climes of Florida or one or two other states where they still allow dog racing, I'll own a couple of greyhounds, and you know, we can also do a greyhound betting tip. Paramutual tips podcast. I will say this to your point, though, when you asked about who was there, it was interesting when I went on the Thursday. So it's Thursday afternoon. So most regular people, even in Florida, if you've got a job, you're at it. I'm going to guess that there were probably, the poker room was very busy, and there were more people inside betting on the horse racing and stuff from around the country than there were outside actually betting on what is going on right there. And exactly. I do think that tracks in America, and this is why I was making that point earlier about how the betting culture in England is very different, where every high street has a couple of betting shops where you can wander in and place bets on, you know, Premier League football or whatever you wish. I feel like the racetrack, the dog track, is actually an excuse for people to go and gamble on other stuff rather than an event in itself. And like I say, at 1 o'clock in the afternoon on a Thursday, I would estimate there are about 60 people on, you know, 8 or 9 different tables playing poker than there were as many people in the poker room as there were sitting in the upper deck watching the greyhound racing where I was. So
yeah, well, that has to do with the legal history of these places, both dog tracks and horse racing tracks, where they were just by themselves originally.
Yeah.
And then they had less people going, and then they're going to decide, hey, state, we need help. So as long as we're doing gambling here, let us do other types of gambling. So you put the slots in at the racetrack, or you put in a poker room or something like that is designed to sustain it. But at some point, the original purpose is lost because, like as you saw, at that point, more people are there for the secondary, what was supposed to support the dog racing industry.
You know, to your point there, I once... here in the Washington, D.C. area where this show emanates from, we're about an hour and 15 minutes in a car from a town in West Virginia called Charlestown. Not Charleston, West Virginia, but Charlestown, which is across the border in West Virginia. They have a casino and a horse racing track, which, you know, during the summer, I'll try and get up there a couple of times in the summer to, you know, bet on the horses, stand by the rail, watch the horses thunder by. But they have a very big, thriving casino. And a couple of years ago, I was up there for another reason, and I was talking to sort of the general manager of the racetrack. And he was very upfront. He said the casino saved... the racetrack had been there for 100 years.
Gracias.
But he was like, the casino saved the racetrack. The racetrack doesn't make money, but profits from the casino help fund the racetrack, which, to your point, gives them a further excuse if you're in a state that doesn't have true legalized sports betting. It gives you a place for
sports betting still, but
no. But what I mean is, people can go to Charlestown, and again, they don't actually watch the meet that's there. They're busy with their form guide inside, watching, you know, 200 TVs betting on horse racing in Florida and horse racing in California and horse racing in Australia or whatever.
At which point, what's the point, right? Like, okay, if a gambling endeavor like horse racing can't make money on its own enough to sustain itself.
But it is making money.
You just said it loses money. The casino makes money.
No, but those people in there at that racetrack are still spending their money. Not what I'm saying is, thanks to the internet and satellite TV and all that type of thing, you can walk into Charlestown and ignore the races there, but spend all kinds of money on the races in California.
My point is, the
business of horse racing is still, from a gambling perspective, it's still making money. Otherwise, it would all go away.
Yeah, well, so if your core business, your actual horse races on site, can't make enough money, maybe it's better just to let them go out of business.
Yeah, but then you have no reason I think the point is you have to have an active racetrack in order.
Well, why? To, well, see, that's
but that's because that's the law of the land.
But it's silly, right? Like that's the thing. If you get to the point where that part doesn't make any, I guarantee you, what they would love to do, if they could legally shut down the horse track
and replace it with off-track betting,
they wouldn't even bother with the off-track betting. They'd just be a casino.
No, because they still make money from. What I'm saying is that casino still makes money.
They make money in the same way that the Keno, you know, screens make money. Like, sure, it makes money because it's might as well be scratch offs at that point.
Okay,
you know,
yeah.
I guess there's slight. Somebody could keep track of the different horses, but let me tell you, that's people are far and few. Few and far between, and the odds are supposed to take that into account anyway.
So it's interesting. Yeah, I feel like you're taking quite a cynical position on it.
I think it's garbage.
But you're a gambler.
It's a silly industry backing up something.
Ooh, that's a big statement.
Silly
industry.
Meaning the horse and the dog stuff. I mean, it's an overblown roulette wheel. Like,
sure.
You know, you could put a roulette wheel on, it costs you whatever dollars it is to buy the machine, or you could have an entire industry that involves bad activity with respect to animals. And I know there's going to be a segment of people out here like, this is ridiculous. Dogs get excited about it. And it's not what happens on the track that's really the issue when it comes to with the horses and the dogs, and more so with the dogs. It's what happens off the track. Because your vision of, oh, you know, someday I'll own two greyhounds is not the way it works. They farm huge numbers of greyhounds and treat them badly and take the two out of every whatever number and then put them on the track, and what happens to the rest of them?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm going to defend the industries.
Based on what?
Because if you're like one of these animals, this is like playing in the NFL. If you're some horse, this is like being in the NFL.
Sure, if you're one of those two, what if you're the 20 others that weren't fast enough?
Well, then you just go to some home and you're living in the house plenty of other animals.
They go and live on a farm. The greyhounds go live in the farm and help pull the sled. How about maybe a decent number of them are just killed?
Sure, but I think I think go one more step than that. I think animal cruelty goes far beyond the racing industry, and that's my point.
Yeah, but
that's my defense. There's all kinds of people being mean to animals. I'll throw a rock at a squirrel. I'm just as bad as someone.
But you're not breeding extra squirrels for that purpose.
No, because there's plenty of them about. Anyway, so I'm going to defend but I will agree with you on one thing. There is definitely a sense with greyhound racing and with horse racing that these are dying.
Yeah, well, that's the other thing is the fans there. You know, it's old people who, and then the younger people who are into it, and it's a limited number, are not the people that you want to share your market base.
Now, I'm not going to say something now as someone who I wouldn't call myself. When I grew up, my dad used to gamble.
You're on the old people side, by the way.
No, my father used to gamble on the horses every afternoon. Sure. As someone who likes a flutter, I think is the expression. I wouldn't call myself a hardcore gambler, but I like a flutter. I struggle. Like, I'm not interested. You just talked about, we might be going to the casino. That would have no interest to me.
Right.
Going and playing roulette is of no interest to me. Playing blackjack is no interest to me. But if I had an opportunity with regularity to bet on college basketball or the NFL or whatever it may be, I would do that more because my relationship with gambling is such that, and it's the same with the horse racing and the dog racing. I like picking up a form guide and looking through the numbers and looking at the dog's times and who it beat and what its record is for the year. And at some moment, I feel like
you can beat the system.
But I'm also engaged in the process. I'm far more engaged in the activity than walking up to a roulette wheel and throwing down chips on six different numbers and watching it go around. Yeah. So all I'm saying is,
you're losing the psychological battle.
What, with roulette?
No, with the people gambling? Run these systems. Like, the point is, the reason they like that is because you're engaged in that. The truth is, you're not going to make any better money off of
it. I'm not suggesting I go and gamble and make money.
Right.
What I'm suggesting is, as a form of entertainment,
okay,
I gain more entertainment from sitting there all afternoon watching the dogs.
If I'm going to lose my money, I'd rather lose my money with
thinking
some
that
suspense,
I might win my
feeling,
money. Exactly.
Rather than the thing spun and it came up red.
Yeah, exactly. It was blackjack, and you asked me about the poker room. I'm one of those people. You know, if televised poker is on, and it's not as big as it was 5 or 6 years ago, I'll still leave it on and have it because I find it's quite soothing to watch, you know, All In and that type of thing. But I don't feel, because I'm not a poker player per se, I never feel I could be good enough where my personal satisfaction from the activity would be such that, well, I won those three hands today. No, I would have no idea. Whereas at least at the horse racing, I go, yeah, there you go. I picked that one. Yeah, he was 3-1. Well, and
I know you enough to know that whenever you do win, you will claim full credit for...
I went twice and I ended up walking out of there $50 ahead of the game. So I'm like, you know, something?
Overall.
So I'm overall. After two afternoons of entertainment, there you go.
Do you know how much betting you did to end up $50? Like, what was your marginal?
No, that was my margin.
I know. I'm saying, like, relative to what? Was that on $500 of betting over the course of the day? Or was that on, like, you know?
I did keep a record. I think I ended up over the two afternoons, I think I spent about $180 and cleared $50 on top of that. So, you know, I got quite lucky. And I like to go and I place different sorts of bets. I place on a dog to win. I place on who's coming first, who's coming second. But again, I find it, I've always found, but even if I'd lost $50, I'd still go, yeah, I'd fun going to the track. I do like the activity. Should we segue to our next topic?
I have a segue for it.
Oh, really? About no, yeah,
as long as we're talking about the sordid underbelly of something. What happened to you recently?
Well, I was going to give you the segue.
Okay, was my segue.
Okay, then, but I'm going to give you the if you want a free tip when you go to the dog track or the horse track and you're not sure who to bet on, if you see a animal relieve itself in the moments while it's being paraded around the track, then if nothing else, you know that one's ready to go and he could be worth a flutter. Which is my segue to the fact that I had my middle-aged...
I liked my sordid underbelly. Oh, you did. Segue better. But
yeah, I had a colonoscopy the other day.
Good times.
Yes, yes. You sleep all the way through it now. No, I'd read online... Well, no.
They give you that stuff that, like, you don't remember what happened.
Well, no, let me say this. I'd read online, and there are people sitting here probably reaching for the off button, because the thought of, we've got to listen to him talk about his colonoscopy. I'd read online, and there are different forms of anesthesia. There's one where they sort of numb your body, but you're awake enough to respond to their commands to roll over and that type of thing. I was confused when I'd gone in for my prep, not really listened, like about a month ago. I'm like, yeah, he's going to, and all I'm thinking about is, yeah, they're going to be sticking things inside me. So I had to double check with the doctor yesterday. Am I going to be half out or fully out? There actually is, where I went yesterday, they just knock you completely out. You have no idea what's going on. You just remember falling asleep, and then you remember waking up. But there is a form of a colonoscopy where you're sort of half awake in case they want you to move around.
You sure about that?
Yeah, I looked it up online.
I know the latter, but the first, like, so I have a doctor friend when he was,
I was completely
doing these
out.
Are you sure about that?
I don't remember anything from being out.
So this is
that being completely out? No. If you don't remember, you're completely out.
There's a version of this stuff where you're aware and awake, but you end up having no memory of it happening. So when you come through it, it's not like it happened to you, even though you were present in the moment when it happened.
But if it came out, under hypnosis, then I would be able to remember. Like all those people have been abducted by aliens.
Oh, maybe, but I don't.
And they've had something stuck up.
I wish I knew the name of this
most
type
alien
of
abductions.
Anesthesia is not even the right word, but I wish I knew the name of the term that this is for. It's some play on the word amnesia. I forget, but
semi amnesia.
No, I mean, but the point is you don't remember it. And if
faux amnesia.
Well, this is what's interesting about it. If you don't remember something happening, but it did happen to you, did it really happen to you? Like in a metaphysical way, does it really matter?
Yeah.
Like if you come out of something and something horrible happened to you, but you have no memory of it, can you really say, did it matter?
I'm going to throw, you just made me think of a question that I have for you now. Have you got to the stage in your life where obviously we are both of indeterminate middle age, so our lives are packed full of memories of our experiences. Do you ever get to the stage where when you're thinking back on something, you're starting to get confused, is that a memory or is that a memory of a dream? I'm getting that more and more where I'm trying to think, did I do that or did I just dream that I do that? Because ultimately memory is all just up there. There you go.
There's a really new like that
for you.
Do you know what you took? Midazolam?
I don't know.
Cause retrograde amnesia. So it means basically, this is the first item under sedation for colonoscopies.
All I know is, I remember lying there and the guy said to me, I'm in the room and I'm surrounded by the people. And the guy said to me, okay, can you roll over on your side? And I did so. And I remember seeing the TV screen where I figure that's what they examine. And I hear the anesthesia lady go, okay, we're going to give you some anesthesia now. Just breathe normally. And I just remember thinking, oh, I've been looking, because these procedures are early in the morning. I had to get up at all kinds of, at the time. And I'm going to give you the unpleasant stuff of a colonoscopy in a moment. I just remember lying there thinking, oh, great, I get to sleep for a little while. And then my eyes close. I do remember my eyes closing. And then the next thing I remember is waking up in the post-op area with the nurses around me. And I'm sitting there going, what time is it? And I was only out for about 20 minutes. So I have absolutely no recollection of someone sticking anything inside me.
Well, see, I just wonder whether your thought that you're asleep is actually correct or not, but it doesn't really matter.
But I guess it doesn't matter, does it? If you don't remember anything, then you're asleep.
It only matters to me because it's funny to think that you thought something that you thought you were asleep, but you weren't really asleep.
Okay.
Anyway,
but if I don't remember, then I'm asleep.
This
right?
is like is this like a full blown checkout, prostate, yeah. everything else, or because I know there's a quickie prostate check that does
no,
not
this had
this
nothing. No, they just did the full colon and all that sort.
And
of
was
thing.
This because you're just of your age, or
of my age? Yeah, and I had a very clean score. Let me tell you the most uncomfortable. If you've not had one of these, I'm going to tell you something. The most uncomfortable thing about it is your prep. So the day before, you're supposed to eat very lightly and plenty of fluids. And then the night before, you basically have to drink. And then you have to drink it again the next morning, a super high-powered laxative. And the most unpleasant part, I know,
people can guess what my face looks like right now.
No. People say, and I'm going to actually make a legitimate point here. When someone says, oh, you're having, oh, you're going for a colonoscopy, people sort of make a joke and their eyes roll because your only thought is someone sticking something into you.
It's the Fletch up.
But that's what I'm saying. That's actually not the unpleasant part of it because you're sleeping through that. The unpleasant part of it is drinking all these laxatives and having to run to the bathroom about 9 times yeah. in a period of 12 hours from the night before to the morning off. That's the unpleasant. The unpleasant part of it is the prep. But the actual colonoscopy, if you said to me, yeah, come on back in tomorrow for one, I'm okay. like, what do I care? I'm sleeping through it.
So
yeah, let's do a double. And double session, doc.
The laxative's unpleasant effects. By the time you're done with the procedure, are you fine the rest of the day in terms of like
I think
restroom use?
Yeah, I mean, I think it wears off relatively. And after the colonoscopy, they just say that if he's had to remove any polyps, you have to follow a pretty... A lighter dietary regimen for about 24 hours, just not to abrase your insides.
So, like, they're in there. But like, if they find, it's not only diagnostic; it's procedural.
They say that if they go in there and find anything, they'll clear it out, and then they send that away for testing. But I was clear of polyps, so therefore, as soon as I got home, soon as I got home, I was mowing back pastries and egg sandwiches from the coffee shop, and oh yeah, I'm like all the way in there. I've clean bill of health. Let's stop at Starbucks and load it up.
Nothing better than an egg sandwich.
Yes. So anyway, that's there's no segue from this to our next topic, other than because you take the day off, you get to watch a lot of TV because you don't go back to work.
One of his shows was a medical show.
Ooh, there you go. So we've had a double segue there. Off post op, you just sit around the house and watch TV. We're going to talk some TV for the remainder of the show. And Eric has mentioned a medical show. So someone had passed away, I think earlier this past week. This show, of course, being recorded at the weekend prior to its release. So by the time you hear this, it would have been about 8 or 9 days ago. TV producer Stephen Bochco passed away. Now, I know you're probably sitting out there going, who is this dude?
Bochco, I can never remember.
We'll
go with Bochco.
We'll go with Bochco. I've always called him Bochco.
Yeah.
Stephen Bochco passed away. He was a renowned creator, producer of TV shows, and we're going to discuss why his death is his passing is notable in terms of his career. His career was notable.
His passing. He's not really, to my knowledge, been involved in. How old was he?
He was quite young. I think he was only.
You've got the Wikipedia page.
74.
I jumped to the wrong thing on mistake. Oh, wait a minute. What's going on? We have a.
Technical difficulty. You didn't plug the thing in.
No, it is plugged in.
You're going to have to stop that and we're going to have to fix it. Honestly. You fixed it?
We
had some technical difficulty. Again, this is the sausage making show.
I'm only picking this one. This is not the one I would plan to pick with, start with, but since it was the medical one.
So this is you're listening to the theme tune from
Doogie Howser MD.
Doogie Howser MD, which was a show that came out in the late 80s. It basically launched Neil Patrick Harris to fame. I think this was one of his first acting roles, and it was about a sort of teen prodigy who becomes a doctor in a hospital. I never watched this show.
I think I saw some of it, but I watch it regularly. But his buddy, his sidekick, ended up being in like mob movies as he got older.
Oh, really?
Or something like that. But boy, what a sound, what a theme song.
Come on, it's the 80s.
Like his whole thing was composed. Hey, it's the guy from, that guy was like all the shows.
Yeah.
With David Kelly, no less.
Yeah, and that's a name we're gonna mention a bit later. So, while you queue up, are you ready to play it now, or do you want me to talk?
Well, I did have like a little bit of it, but we could just talk over it. Like, meaning I had like a clip of...
Okay, that'll be four Italian hoagies.
This guy.
Two bags of chips, two cherry Slurpees, and a carton of Chocho bars. That'll be $624.72.
Uh-huh. Delpino, I thought you knew how to use the register.
I thought I did too.
Read the manual.
Anyway, I'll flip ahead, but continue to talk anyway.
So Stephen Bochco released a whole load of TV... Released. He wrote, produced a whole load of TV shows. We are going to talk about some of them, but I'm going to start naming them. And I guarantee that you would have heard of at least a couple of these. Looking at his Wikipedia page, you know, he'd worked in TV as a writer. He'd been involved in shows like Columbo and Ironside. And then his first success, where he was basically a showrunner, meaning that he's written it and he's producing it on a regular basis, was Hill Street Blues, which is won all kinds of Emmys. It was the first of its kind as a cop show, and we'll come to that in a moment. Okay. He also done, while you get this stuff ready, he also went on to do Doogie Howser that you've just heard. L.A. Law and NYPD Blue are a couple of other of his shows.
He's a male black, age approximately 30, 6 feet 6 inches tall.
This is the roll call of Hill Street Blues. We've talked about Hill Street Blues before, in our cop shows and things. Like, I think it arrived. It was one of our top.
Blue cocktail type dress.
Yeah, we talked about it on our theme show, TV theme show special from a couple of years ago.
Item 16, gang homicides.
We had two last night. So they're going to be reprisals. You got anything to add to that, LaMonica?
Yes, sir. It looks like the 124th Street gang done it.
Oh, pure genius.
You can tell just by listening to the audio, like, it's not.
Last item is a directive from Divisional Commander Swanson.
It's intended to be authentic sounding.
Yeah. Of bizarre and unauthorized weapons by the officer.
I have a question for you, because I never watched Hill Street Blues. Was this the famous Let's Be Careful Out There?
Yeah, I'm trying to get to that point.
Okay.
Let's roll. Hey, let's be careful out here.
So basically every week on Hill Street Blues, it would open with this scene of the duty sergeant, or whatever he is, the duty commander, briefing everyone on his watch, his uniformed police officers, before sending them out in a unnamed North American, I think, East Coast city.
Right.
I think it's probably supposed to be like
Philadelphia. It was him until he passed away.
Yeah,
and then the other guy, who's his saying was, let's do it to them or get them before
let's get
they
them
get
before
us.
They get us.
Which is not as good.
Hill Street Blues was notable because it was the first of its kind. It was an anthology show, meaning that there were, you know, a dozen different characters at any which time. But up until Hill Street
Blues, I
don't
think that's what anthology means. But okay.
Well, anyway, up until its time, cop shows were much more linear. You have Starsky and Hutch, and they're chasing the villains. And over the course of the show, the villains will commit their crime. Starsky and Hutch and whoever else will catch them. And, you know, the world will go back on its axis of law and order and justice.
Well, it's...
But Hill Street Blues wasn't... But what I mean is Hill Street Blues was about the lives of policemen,
yeah,
rather than this notion of good versus bad that will play out over the course of an hour. Do you know what I mean?
Well, most shows, not just cop shows, but generally shows, were encapsulated, and it was almost like the other episode didn't matter. And this was called serializing, which of course wasn't brand new. I mean, had soap operas for many years that were serialized, that it mattered what happened last week to what had happened next week, and there was a history and all that. But this was the first major it was the most prominent recent or integration of that concept into a show that normally in the past, like Dragnet, would be beginning, crime solved, end.
Right.
And you could pick any episode and you wouldn't be like, oh, I don't really understand the backstory on this person. So
I mean, and every police drama up until that moment had been a variant of what you've just said, whether it was Starsky and Hutch, which I spoke about, or those countless Private Eye shows that existed during the 70s. They were all variations of that theme. Yeah. Crime, good guys show up, things get solved at the end. Little orphan kid has somewhere to live, whatever it may. Do you know what I mean? Whereas Hill Street was a forerunner, because all TV, all cop shows are like this now, to an extent.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Even the ones that have good That's versus
like
bad.
All the Law and Orders are encapsulated in terms of their crimes.
Right.
But they are, like, it matters. Like, you know what happened with, exactly. like, who was having an affair with
right.
Michael Conrad. Is the last
Michael
player.
Conrad, yeah. Of course, one of the most famous TV
theme
tunes.
I mean, this thing became like a, on the radio, you'd hear this as a regular song. That James Sicken guy was the guy who was in Doogie Howser.
Right. So I never watched, my mum, bless her, watched Hill Street Blues when it was on TV in England. She loved it. I never really got into it.
Eddie Thomas is a big director these days, I think.
I never really got into it myself because, it was growing up in England, it was sort of one of those shows that was on once a week at 11 o'clock at night, and it sort of had a cult following. In that, I say that now, there are some exported American TV shows that do very well across the world. And, 30 years ago, the sort of police procedural that we just spoke about, those shows were huge across the rest of the world because you can throw them up there, there you go. Was a show like Hill Street Blues, when it went abroad, it ended up at sort of like odd times, and it just had this hardcore...
You couldn't just DVR
it. Yeah, it had this hardcore following who followed it, and my mom was one of those people. I never watched it, although when I did come to America, I did get sucked into his next big show, and I'm not going to stop you talking about Hill Street if you want to, but his next big show was L.A. Law.
Yeah, right. I got that. Hold on a sec. All these things are like resetting to where I was.
I want to solicit her entertainment business.
I've never felt vindictive toward
you.
In the dark and scary.
Trying to find the theme.
There it is. I haven't heard this theme in a long time.
Where is that saxophone player now? Susan Day of the Partridge Family.
Yeah. The sort of the original sort of name star was Harry Hamlin.
Yeah.
Who had sort of flirted with a movie career and sort of second fiddle on different shows.
Corbin Burnson, you know.
But Corbin Burnson, it was his character Arnie Becker was the sort of the breakout character. Jimmy Smits was on it,
yep.
Who ended up working again for Bochco on NYPD Blue. It's interesting.
And he's in Star Wars, so.
Oh, of course, yeah. Well, in the three movies that suck.
He's actually in the new
ones. Oh, he's in the new ones as well? Yeah. Okay, so he's not in the first three movies are great, the last three movies that suck, but the movies
skipped
that
over. There's a couple of carryovers. Like, there's definitely some actors who appear, like Barbara Bosson, who is like Ferrillo's ex-wife, and the other thing, she appears in L.A. Law in a few episodes.
I can never decide with L.A. Law. I wrote this down on the notes just to make myself sound clever. I can't decide if... You know, L.A. Law obviously was about lawyers.
What years was that?
It was in the mid-80s. And so whenever I don't see it often on reruns.
Did it run into the 90s?
It ran into the early 90s, but okay. It was a big show in the 80s. It was one of the first big shows on NBC's Thursday night lineup, which for about a decade and a half was like the number one night.
So
on
it was
TV.
Like the nighttime show after the comedies? Like
yes.
After Cosby and everything?
Yeah, and so that whole night of TV, that whole night of TV was huge for NBC, and this notion that, yes, there's a midweek night in that you can make all kinds of money if you're a network.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, having just watched those credits now, because obviously we're watching them while you're only hearing the music, I looked at it and yeah, it's 80s TV.
Yeah.
And so, but I can't decide, is L.A. Law, is it TV that defined a decade, or is it defined by its decade? And what I mean by this was, the 80s was this sort of beginning of Hill Street first, and then I think the formula was really sort of refined in L.A. Law, and then after L.A. Law, the formula was taken to its like nth level with ER, which is not a Stephen Bochco show, but this notion of an not an anthology, I wish I knew what that word was now, of a TV drama that had a TV serial that was both serious but had some pathos, that had some humor and encapsulated all these things. And prior to the 80s, I think watching TV Decisions were made for you. This is a comedy. You will laugh when you watch it. That's a cop show. It'll be exciting when you watch it. These dramas like L.A. Law and to a lesser extent, and you know, NYPD Blue, they encapsulate all these different things. And now when we watch TV, I think as viewers, we don't watch TV and expect just laughs or just drama.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I think prior to the 80s, TV was a lot less sophisticated, is the wrong word. Do you know what I mean?
Nuanced. It was more like more clubbing you over the head with a particular line, right. of, a line of events.
But anyway,
Brady Bunch, it's just the Brady Bunch.
It's was just not exactly. Like, like a, so Bochco then went on, he did Doogie Howser.
So Doogie Howser, yeah, we kind of flipped through that real quickly. If anybody doesn't know it, Doogie Howser, Neil Patrick Harris, who is obviously a big star nowadays, was playing a child prodigy doctor. And so he was a doctor at a hospital, but he was only in his teens or something like that, and so his buddy was his teenage, you know, was his like buddy, his, you know, friend, like that the kids would have. So it was, I don't think it was, you know, I didn't watch enough to know how dramatic it was, but looking at the clips, it does seem like it wasn't like a goof of a I think it had more comedy in there than the other shows, but it's not like it was a comedy about like a kid who's doing, you know, with a laugh track that like, ooh, look, no. he's doing something childlike. It was much more about, I don't know, being a kid, but drama of being.
But here's the interesting
story.
Thing: it was a 30-minute show, and at that time, I think most of the audience were conditioned that if something was 30 minutes, it was supposed to be funny or not taken too seriously.
Right.
Whereas if something was an hour, it was of more import.
Yeah.
In terms of the notion of the drama of it.
We have to leap to one of his failures, though, and say here's an area where he thought there was a wave to be dealt with, but he did not make it. So let me, this one, because here's the funny thing. This clip is called Let's Be Careful Out There, and it even starts similarly off. It starts off with roll call, like the Hill Street Blues.
Like Hill Street Blues.
Item 7, November 29, 3 p.m. Conflict right. resolution.
Sounds very much like the other one.
Yeah.
It's a little cleaner, but I need to get to the point where it shows what it's all about.
Item 8. Officer Quinn returns to active duty roster tomorrow. So, Yeager, you'll ride with Cerruto.
Oh, Lieutenant, give me a break. Yeager's got yak breath. I can't ride with him.
So wear a gas mask. Item last. On the teletype, we still got the Franklin Avenue flasher. Struck at 2 outdoor weddings and a school picnic so far this month.
So this is now, this is still the roll call sergeant who's now singing the remainder of his announcements, cop rock.
This show was cop rock from 1990, and if any show defines the phrase concept TV, it would be this. It was basically a cop show that was also a musical.
Yeah.
On TV. There you go, yeah. And I got to tell you something.
Oh, look, he's even playing keyboards.
Oh, really? Oh, that's right. They have a piano now. So it really is high concept TV. It's, you know, Hamilton meets cop shows, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what it was. And it bombed.
Yes. Well,
and to be fair,
because it's stupid.
And at some moment, and I want to make 2 points. You can be Stephen Bochco and be a genius and have all kinds of hits. There are going to be some donkeys in there.
Yeah. I mean, I understand. They were looking at MTV and they were thinking, here's a thing we can do. The problem is, you know, even on MTV, people didn't really generally sit and watch, you know, endless songs. And, you know, you could have it on the background. People weren't going to sit down for an hour and watch a thing. Because when they break into song, what it didn't foresee is the lack of attention span on music and where we went with that. But
there is a part of me who believes, as much as I think this idea is moronic, and I'm going to read a straight quote. The latter combined straight police drama with live action Broadway singing and dancing.
Yeah.
And was one of his highest profile failures. Now, I can read that first part of the sentence back again, and it will never in a million years sound like a good idea to me. The latter combined straight police drama with live action Broadway singing. I just don't get that, because it wasn't dealing with something that started off camp. But I know that around this time last year when we talked about Adam West passing, we talked about Batman the TV show. Obviously, that was from 20 years earlier, and it was already in a different place. But the notion of taking something straight up and turning it into a musical, I will never think that's a good idea.
Yeah.
That being said, I just name-checked Hamilton which is, you know, that massive Broadway drama, and Les Miserables, which I'm sure many of our listeners have seen. I have not, because I don't do that sort of thing.
You've never seen Les
Miserables? Never seen. I'm not interested. It's French people. It's period, too. I don't do period. I don't do period pieces. I don't like anything that where there's absolutely no possibility of a car chase. While I think it's a moronic idea, I will never sit here and say at some moment in time, someone won't make that fly.
Yeah, right. Well.
But maybe not as a TV show. And that's my point. If you go to the theater and it is a police drama with singing and dancing in it, and you're sitting in the theater.
Do you recognize that voice?
No.
The voice just before was Sheryl Crow in Cop Rock.
Oh, really?
Yeah. As an undercover cop. She finished her part here, although maybe she's going to come back and see her. That's her.
Oh, yeah, look, Sheryl Crow on Cop Rock.
That was her there. So I think she was a backup singer for Michael Jackson at that time, like that. So
Cop Rock was one of Bochco's biggest failures, but he quickly followed that up with
probably, I think, his biggest success. Overall.
His biggest success for a lot of different reasons, and me personally, my favorite of all his shows, and still one of the best 5 to 7 TV shows basically ever.
And he had updated his intro music now. Yeah. It didn't sound quite so... Like, you could see this on a slightly dated, but it's not like the other stuff. David Milchin.
So that's NYPD Blue.
Yeah.
Which was sort of...
This is a series of clips on Sipowitz, so we'll...
Clearly NYPD Blue, when he pitched that to, I think it ran on ABC, he pitched, look, this is my updated version of Hill Street Blues. So it was a cop show that, again, balanced cop stories, like every week, the lead detectives, and it started off Dennis Franz and David Caruso, and Caruso left after he was replaced by Jimmy Smits, who Bochco would work with. You know, they would solve crimes, but it combined that with their sort of their personal lives.
Yeah.
And it was known because it was the first primetime TV show that would show butt nudity and sort of have words. I don't think they ever used the S word, but no. There was sort of, they pushed the line for 25 years ago as to what words could be heard on TV. I remember when it came out, it was quite controversial. There were a lot of local affiliates that refused to air it, especially in more conservative parts of the country, who felt it was pushing the envelope too much for free over-the-air TV. I'm sure now if you watch HBO and stuff like that, all this kind of thing seems rather mild. But Hill Street, I don't know. I'm sorry, Hill Street. NYPD Blue. I can still watch it in reruns now. And there are moments when you go, wow, this is really good stuff for a over-the-air TV show.
Yeah.
There are some great scenes, some great characters. Take the test.
What was it? Sipowitz?
SIPOWICZ.
What are you doing?
Give us a little privacy.
Privacy? What for?
You're counting on your victims not testifying.
I don't have any victims.
You work bars where guys went who were in the closet deep. Men with families and jobs and lives.
My partner is playing, you know, one of the many interrogation scenes with NYPD Blue where cops are hitting guys with phone books and stuff like that, which even 25 years ago was relatively, I think shocking is the wrong word, but I still think as a society we're in a place where, ooh, you can't do that, ooh, that's above the law, that type of thing.
Yeah.
And yet the show tried to sort of make the case that this is, we've used the expression a lot, this is how sausage is made. It would be interesting now, I think now in the car, I don't want to suddenly get off track, but if you had a cop show now and you did stuff like that with all that goes on in the world, I'm not sure people's eyes would be raised as much. But I remember there were still moments in NYPD Blue where, if you remember when it was made, you go, ooh, this is the first time cops on TV have been like this.
These shows migrated over to cable and HBO and stuff. I mean, that's, so now you could have The Wire, you could have those kind of shows that are going to.
But all those shows, I think there was a, I think in his obituary, which we didn't bring down, that was in the Washington Post, someone, I can't remember who it was, but someone made the comment, it may have been his quote, someone made the comment that without a show like NYPD right. Blue, the show like The Sopranos doesn't
yeah.
exist.
Yeah, it's he's a gateway in the changes. You know, all these stuff we talk about great TV shows nowadays. This was a transition point before everything was on the cable, before you were mentioning before we got on, talking about like folks who are, he was a TV guy. He didn't do movies on the side, and now you have people who dabble in all these different yeah. things. And it was not a single step up to an elevated form of entertainment, but it was clearly an important midpoint on the ladder, you know, well, like that he did certain things that then transitioned to
the here's a direct quote from him in 2008. So 10 years ago, he said this. He was arguing that the new home for quality primetime drama was cable, where, and I now quote, the atmosphere is far friendlier and the creative environment more conducive to doing original work. And most of what's passing for primetime drama these days isn't very good. Now, this was a guy who was in TV, and as to your point there, you know, he didn't do movies. He had his office / his studio, his production company, and someone from a network would probably call him up and go, what have you got? What can you pitch us? And he would make TV shows. But even 10 years ago, he was now making the point that, you know, that kind of thing is going out the door. Now I'm going to talk to cable companies when they call me because I can push the envelope more and the boundaries are not quite the same. And if I want to do a show that's an hour and 15 minutes and not 52 minutes with commercials, I can do that. What is interesting, why I think his death is notable, and I did want to get to this point, and you touched on it right there. He's the last of his kind. Like a guy who just did that, who just made TV shows. Because now,
well, I'm going to... There's some who just make, like, still no, just but, make TV shows. But I mean, he's the last extent, where...
I mean,
that,
again... I mean,
that was making that type
I'm,
of
I'm going to throw another TV show. Before I get to my point, I'm going to throw another TV show that was kind of a failure. It was a show called Murder One. And it ran for 2 seasons. And the whole point of the show was, we're just going to follow one case for 20 episodes. And the show didn't do very well for all kinds of reasons. That was in 1997. But now, two decades later, I mean, what was one of the best shows on TV, I thought, from last year on FX was American Crime Story, the one about O.J. Simpson. And now they're doing it again with, who is it? The fashion designer who was killed.
Versace.
But the whole Versace, where they follow a story start to finish. But what I'm saying is, there is a part of Bochco where he's ahead of his time. He was ahead of his time a little bit with Hill Street,
but
definitely ahead of his time with NYPD Blue, and ahead of his time with an idea like that. So that's why I think his passing is notable, because he wasn't just an... Again, I'm going to throw another name at you. If you watch TV shows from the 80s, there are two names that will come up on a lot of shows. One is Stephen J. Cannell, who is a writer and producer. He was responsible for The Rockford Files, and then in the 80s, he was responsible for a lot of TV like The A-Team, which we would sit there and go, these things are big hits, but on a artistic level, they're kind of throwaway. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. They're just shows. And I'm not knocking them because I used to watch a lot of that stuff.
No, you can knock them.
There was another name, Donald Belisario, who I think was responsible for Knight Rider and the original Battlestar Galactica. These guys made TV shows. And Stephen Bochco was one of them, but Bochco was doing something that I think has left the mark now in terms of how TV is made. And that's why I think his passing is quite notable.
I mean, one difference on those shows is that we've made a turn in a lot of these art forms to nonfiction, just the same with like books. You know, people are talking lately about like nobody wants to buy a novel that's about some like in-depth thing. If they're going to read something that's in-depth and it's like they want to have it be based on a true story.
Right.
You know, so it's sort of interesting, but that's not essential.
So I do want to make a case now using it as an example. I just started watching this week, it's on FX, the show about the Gettys called Trust.
Right.
Now, it's first couple of episodes, and its producer and its writer...
Isn't this the second season, though?
No, it's his first season. It was the movie that came out. Remember the movie that got recast with... No, it's his first season. Donald Sutherland plays Getty, all kinds of other faces. But the show has been created by Danny Boyle, who's the Hollywood director of Slumdog Millionaire and 127 Hours and the two Trainspottings. And him and the writer has worked on movies. But what I'm saying is now... TV shows, it's movie people, rather than Stephen Bochco, who is just a TV guy. He didn't do movies.
Yeah.
I mean, I look at someone like J.J. Abrams.
Well, that's just
But J.J. Abrams, he started with Felicity and Lost, and in a strange way, he could have been the next Stephen Bochco, but because of his own abilities and because of the marketplace, if you said to someone... I think most people, if you mention the name J.J. Abrams to
or Abrams,
them, Abrams yeah. they would say Star Trek, Star Wars, Spielberg, all kinds of other stuff.
Well, and lost.
if you Lost, but yeah, but Lost is now 15, 20 years ago. Felicity, but what I'm saying is, yeah, what I'm saying is that the art forms of Conan emerged a little bit. Remember, yeah. House of Cards, the TV version, was started by David Fincher, who's more known for Seven, The Game.
So I want to play a clip because with that backdrop, here's, if you want to have another reason to dislike Chevy Chase, and there's more than ample enough reason to like it, there's you can go on YouTube and you look up Bochco and Chevy Chase. And
I understood there would be no math.
From in 1997, it's Politically Incorrect with Bill Maher, which I forget what it was on, but it must have
HBO.
Had... But it, like, the way this, I watched the whole thing, and it has breaks. Like, ooh. So like, I don't know if it was on Comedy Central.
Was it Comedy? I can't remember, because Bill Maher's had so many different shows. He's got a show now.
So it's anyway,
on HBO, but anyway.
Let's see if it'll come up to things, but...
I have my doctor's notes, so I'm okay. How did you feel about the war?
Which one? Oh, no, this is what he's going to give him a hard time about Vietnam. So it ends up with Chevy Chase excoriating, like... people watching TV.
Okay.
People, you know, kids, they watch too much TV, and TV is all junk, and there's no reason to watch TV.
It sounds like my parents.
He's got a person in front of him who's like, you know, elevating the form to some degree, and he's running after it. And this is Chevy Chase, by the way. Chevy Chase, who's never made like a higher art form of anything in his life. He almost basically gets up partway through the thing when people start
challenging. Well, and to be fair, Chevy Chase, who actually worked on Saturday Night Live, and also had a go in the 90s having a chat show of his own. So for someone past that to turn his knob to TV is a little bit disingenuous.
All these horrible things, but at the end of the day, everyone wants a military that will protect...
Yeah, now we're on the wrong topic. It's like a whole episode of the thing, so...
Maybe we can just put the link up if you can't find the bit and people can watch themselves.
On NYPD Blue, but the bare bottoms, what does it add?
And the show is kind of funny for being so quaint. Like, he's joking about bare bottoms and these things that they're talking about. Like, you're like, this is only 20 years ago.
Here we go.
In 40 minutes, I just want to finish this one thing. A kid will believe, after watching this day in and day out, that in 40 minutes, a murder will take place and be cleared.
Like, is that what we were really, like, kids cured. Were watching the show and they were had a misapprehension about how criminal things...
It's drama, it's TV, it's rating points.
Excuse me.
It has nothing to do with real life.
Excuse me, if you have watched any of the shows I've done over the years, you know that we are a show that tells very complex stories over... Well, come on, don't be rude.
Thomas Hardy.
Hey, excuse me, don't be rude. Don't be rude. Let me just talk for a second.
All right.
You know, we tell complex stories about the consequence of people's behaviors.
Yeah, it's like Bruce, man.
He's good, though.
No,
he's the best.
He is good. We're arguing about the issue of television.
But you're arguing
about the bar. Well, I'm talking about my shows.
You should.
And you're being a jerk.
Steven's shows. In fact, they're the best ones.
They're the best ones.
He does sort of say that, but then he goes on this stupid rant, and I'm like...
But to be fair, Chevy Chase was actually making a legitimate point about TV prior to Stephen Bochco.
Yeah, well, it's the fact that he's yelling at Stevie Bochco
that's the irony of it.
Idiotic. He should be busy going like, oh, I wish more people would do what you're doing. But it's classic Chevy Chase, because he's like, the whole world revolves around the things he does, and he somehow is somehow above this stuff. And like, can you think of any, like, Chevy Chase never even ventured into something that was beyond, like, Saturday Night Live was the most sophisticated thing I think he's ever done.
Yeah, his talk show was terrible.
Yeah, well,
remember that?
Like,
Chevy
Chase
show?
You know, his movie. I mean, listen, Fletch is entertaining, and some of these movies were entertaining, not all of them.
Well,
but they're not
got hit by a
water
buffalo.
They're not particularly
good.
They're not like aspiring for anything broader
And so I think that's probably a good way to end with Stephen Bochco. He made TV that aspired to be a bit more than TV.
Mm-hmm.
And in the act, his shows, I think, and sure, there are other factors, the advent of cable, all that kind of thing. But I think he's notable because, I don't know, he's changed TV. I don't know.
Yep.
I'm going to say that. If you're sitting around the house and you're off sick, or maybe you've gone for your colonoscopy in your home and you have nothing else to do and you've got to stay home for 12 hours, if you find a TV show that's created by Stephen Bochco and is just running 9 episodes in a row on some podunk, you know, local station, sit and watch those 9 episodes in a row.
Watch some of it.
And when you're done, you're going to go, well, that's pretty good stuff.
Yeah. So as long as you were plugging that... Getty show. I'm going to plug The Terror, which is a show on AMC, which is sort of based on real life in the sense that it's about a couple of ships from England in the 1840s seeking the Northwest Passage. And this is a true fact. These ships and the characters are actually folks. These in real life, well, I think this is what's going to happen in the main life too, but in the show, but nobody ever finds out what happened to them. They get snowbound up there and everybody disappear somehow. Well, they've taken this and they've used it as a launching point for basically a horror series.
Really?
You know, it's like it's part period piece, which you like, where like they're talking about all these nautical things and like real, I don't want to say science, but there's like a science of this ship exercise of going through the Arctic and there's a historical element of, you know, there was a wave of this kind of exploration as the British Navy and were trying to find these great ways around the top of North America. So there's that element, but then they launch off because they basically the boats get frozen where they are and they're stuck there for years or a year and change. And now there's only been three episodes on AMC. You can watch it on demand and catch up.
Is it real
good actors. I mean, like one of the actors is, I forget his name, but he was the British guy who was in charge of the Mad Men office, you know, the office,
oh yeah, yeah,
you
know, yeah, like yeah,
the
yeah,
red hair, and the other one,
the one who kills himself,
the other one, Sirian Hines, who was in Game of Thrones most recently, but obviously been lots
Tinker
of different
Taylor Soldier Spy, so, the movie with Gary Oldman.
So it's a pretty good show so far.
I've
been advocating it to people, but you told me you weren't going to watch it because it's a period piece. But it's not a real period piece. It's not like is Elizabethan England.
I'm now going to be in tribute to Stephen Bochco. I'm now going to be the TV producer who's pitching this series to you, the executive. Remember Lost in Space, where they were stuck in one place and they had adventures every week? This is just like Lost in Space, except that guy's trapped on an old British war vessel.
If anything, it may turn out to be more like Lost.
Is it fantasy? So what I'm saying, are there fantasy elements or is it straight up?
At this point, we don't know who the bad is. Like what it is that's the baddie that they're contesting and what they're dealing
with.
And
they don't know, more to the point.
Right. Definitely elements of it that seem fantastical, but it's not like it's an overall world is magic kind of
but
thing.
But in a strange way, if you're them 200 years ago, who knows? Yeah.
When so they say, to old cultures, I forget the quote is exactly like anything that's higher science you can't explain comes off as magic. So who knows? But that's not really what this is about.
So that's The Terror on AMC. I'm going to pitch to you Trust on FX, which is about Geddes.
I think we should take the other topic and
do it another time.
Yeah, do it another time, because then you give you a chance to watch it a couple more. Both of us watch it a couple more times, but we'll talk about it later on.
So anyway, that's been TV for the week.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also my procedure, and then Greyhounds.
And Greyhounds.
Yeah.
I like to hear, we should set up a poll with this, how many people think Greyhound racing is creepy or not.
Yeah, do it. Come on, comment on the blog and hammer me.
We could do a Twitter poll. We'll have to look at how you do that. I've never done that before, but I think you can build a poll into the Twitter feed.
And
we announce this thing, we can say, and we can follow it up with how many people.
Yeah, Greyhound racing,
for all
good
of our Twitter followers.
Yes, quite. is that it for the week?
It is.
This has been The Atlantic Voice. I'm Zeph.
I'm Eric. Take care.
You've just enjoyed Eric and Zeph on the Atlantic Voice podcast. Follow us on Twitter at Atlantic_voice. You can find the show at Libsyn.com, iTunes, and of course at AtlanticVoice.net. Email us at AtlanticVoice@gmail.com. And now on YouTube, search for The Atlantic Voice. The Atlantic Voice, 3,000 miles of opinion.